This Week in Radio Tech, episode 203, is brought to you by the Axia Element IP Audio Console, the top of the line and the perfect workhorse console for almost anyone, from two faders to 40, and all you can play audio I.O. Over 4,000 Element consoles are playing radio right now on the web at axiaaudio.com/element. Hey, Dave Suplee is the market engineer for the Cumulus stations in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. He's also a key go-to guy when new studios need to be designed and built or refurbished. From studio design to wiring techniques, Dave's sharing his years of studio building wisdom, plus transmitter side advice. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, and yes, the founder of this fine podcast, This Week in Radio Tech, where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower and everything in between, and even some stuff that's outside of that. If you're a radio engineer, well, want to be a radio engineer, if you're interested in audio engineering, what really matters and what doesn't, like monster cable, and all those kinds of things, then this is the show for you. We're glad to have you join us. Our show is brought to you by folks who are my employer, and I really appreciate them, the TELUS Alliance. And this show is brought to you by the Axia Element Audio Console. What a workhorse. And we'll tell you a bit more about it halfway through the show. All right, let's bring our guest. I'm pleased that today it's a one-on-one show. I get the whole hour with Dave Suplee of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Hi, Dave. Welcome in.
Hi, Kirk. Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm delighted to have you here. Dave, how long have I known you? What, 8, 9 years or so?
I think the first time I spoke with you was not in person, but I was in a car with Gary Klein. I was driving from, I think Gary was driving. I was taking my life in my hands that day. And Gary was driving. I was riding, and we were listening to the virtues of this new IP audio system that that you were coming out with. Mm. And I mean, I'm thinking that that would have been, or had, it was already out at that point, but we had not adopted any of the systems yet at that time, but this was 2004 or 5. It's been almost 10 years, eight or 9 years.
This year is Axia's 10th anniversary of actual studios being built, so probably was close to 10 years ago. We probably had put in, you know, like WOR and the maybe the station in Auburn, Alabama, that was the first you know, audio over IP user for studios. So yeah, boy, it's been about 10 years, and I do remember Gary introducing you as his guy who goes and builds studios, and I sure got that impression that you know, with Cumulus, your employer, Gary's employer, you know, on the grow, that you would go around and build studios here and there. Is that about right?
I built studios. I built individual studios. I've built studio clusters for Cumulus. I've refurbed studio clusters. I've installed transmitters. I've installed automation systems. And flown around the country and caused trouble for people. It's using my calling card if I can take every radio station in a cluster off the air in the middle of afternoon drive. I did that in Dallas one time.
Oh, no. Now, even though we started talking about Axia, our sponsor, the show is not all about Axia. What we're here to talk about is some of Dave Suplee, who's an engineer who's been in the trenches. You know, Dave could just as well be on one of our War Stories episodes with transmitters and studio sites and working all over the country. I mean, quite the traveling guy, and, you know, having to plan studios. And, you know, Dave, I guess sometimes building a new studio, rebuilding studio, and working on transmitter sites, this is a lot like changing the oil on a motorcycle as it's going down the road 60 miles an hour.
Sometimes it can be, absolutely. It's especially, you know, moving into a new building, that's the easy part. Or if you're moving into a new studio, but trying to rehab one while it's still operating. We did that in Bridgeport a couple of years ago, and at Weeby and WICC up there, the station had been hit by a tornado. And we had gone through, and, you know, the studios were intact, but it had done a lot of damage to the building, and we managed to seize the opportunity and rebuild the whole place with an Axia system, by the way. And so we've got a couple of Element building full of Element consoles and power stations. And so we were building the place while they were still operating the two stations, which are both pretty active. Doing talk shows and every other thing that they do. So that turned out to be quite a bit of a challenge. We wound up playing musical chairs pretty often with, okay, now this week you're going to be operating out of this room, and then next week you're going to be over in that room whenever we're tearing these walls out and repainting this and bringing the furniture in.
So tell me a bit about this. You said the station got hit by a tornado, and this is Bridgeport, Connecticut?
Bridgeport, Connecticut, they had a rare tornado that came through, and I'm thinking it was I'm thinking that, let's see, it was 2011 that we redid it, and so it was the year before. It was like in May or June, I think, 2010, and a tornado came through downtown Bridgeport and did a lot of damage. You know, it's you don't think of that in the Northeast, but it does happen. It's rare, but it does happen.
Yeah, I know. As a weather guy, I know there have been tornadoes in all 50 states, but Connecticut is pretty rare.
I know.
And to hit the radio station.
Hit the radio station.
Hit the studio, transmitter, both?
The studio building.
Okay.
We didn't really have any damage at the studio building. It was a seventh floor of an office building right in downtown Bridgeport. And it had the real damage. It took an STL antenna that was on the roof and turned it into a pretzel. And it lifted up a big air conditioning unit, one of those monster units, and dropped it over on its side, still on the roof. It didn't take it off the roof, but it did quite a bit of damage to the roof of the building, and that's so we had quite a bit of water damage in our space because we were on the top floor, and that's where a lot of our trouble started. We started seeing rainwater pouring in through the roof of some of the studios.
So after the tornado went through, the damage was a pit. What sorts of things started happening first? Do you get a little short timeline here of, you know, water's pouring in? What do people do, and how soon do you or other engineers get there to help out?
Well, everybody evacuated the building. We were required to evacuate. Once they determined that the building it was safe for them to return, our engineer at the time, Ed Butler, who was on site and assessed the situation, and we had a number of calls and determined what we were going to do. Fortunately, we were able to operate. Our equipment was pretty much intact. But over the long haul, we were able to, over the next couple of months, we were able to secure the funding to rebuild the place, because we had been at a kind of a turning point there of whether we were, because our lease was about up, so we were going to stay or we were going to go. And we determined to stay, and the building was being rehabbed, and we got some funding from there and some funding from Cumulus, and we were able to rebuild the place.
Wow. Well, I'm glad nobody was hurt, but gee.
But that was almost almost a year from the time that the tornado hit for us to actually be operating with the new studios.
Oh, wow. Wow. So one thing that became apparent in chatting with you, I know I met you at an NAB show, and we were chatting about some wiring techniques. And I tell you, I just didn't have the right words to say to describe how audio wiring could be different when you use an audio over IP system. And it doesn't matter whether it's an Axia system or a Wheatstone or one based on Dante, you know, something from SAS or Logitech. It doesn't matter. There are some new and interesting things that you can do that I think make your life simpler when you're wiring. And it seems like I remember, maybe it was at this station in Bridgeport, that it's just so natural to go buy a bunch of punch blocks and set them all up and start punching all your audio wires down. Is there still a reason that you are doing that when you build studios?
We did that. We did a combination. You know, there's the two schools of thought, and school of thought one is with the AOIP systems. You take your nodes and you put your you put them wherever they're needed. If you have a rack of STL equipment, you want to hook up to that. You put the node in there, and you just go point to point right from the nodes into the equipment. And I've seen that done, and that's very effective. And that's what we did at the studios. We didn't do the punch blocks. We didn't do any of that really in the studios. And it turned out to be very, very effective for us and very quick. In the rack room, we ran all of the nodes out to blocks. And the reason that I did that, we ran them out to chrome blocks. And the reason I did that was because I wanted to distribute my loads a little bit, so that I could, if I wanted to have the STLs, I had my main STLs on one node, a backup STL on a different node, and I didn't really have the ability to run multiple one nodes.
Yeah, is that because if one node fails, then you know the node where your audio is coming in and out of from the AOIP system, that kind of becomes an extension of your whole STL system. And
if
a node fails, well, you got another node that's providing audio for your backup STL system.
Right. Right. Okay. That's why I did it that way. It gave me a way of having a little bit more redundancy, and we could get in there remotely and work around it, because you know a lot of these stations are not staffed that much. So you know, being able to go into the station through VNC or what have you, I could go in, get into the Pathfinder, and change the route and be back on the air if I had a hardware failure of some kind. I thought that would be a little bit easier for us to maintain in the long term. And that's you know, typically, obviously, in a perfect world, you're going to have enough nodes in your facility that you don't necessarily need to do that. But we ran it pretty tight and didn't really have a lot of extra capacity built into the system. So
gotcha.
We made our redundancy that way by distributing it.
When somebody talks to you, let's say Gary Klein or maybe a station manager or a program director comes to you and starts talking about, okay, we need a new studio. It's time to build a new studio. What goes through your mind first, and what kind of questions do you as an engineer ask to figure out, all right, what size console are you going to need? Does it need to be a sit-down or stand-up? Where does other equipment need to go in proximity to the operator? You know, that used to be back before we had automation systems doing a lot of our all of our music and commercials. Now we had decisions to make about cart machines and CD players and other turntables even and tape machines that needed to be within arm's reach or at least remote control reach of the jock. What are your considerations now for planning a new studio?
It's really not as it's not probably not as important as it used to be in those terms, because you're right, you don't have the cart machines, you don't have the reel-to-reels, you know, you don't have all the other things that the peripheral equipment that you used to have. You basically have the automation system and maybe, you know, the phone system. In most studios, that, you know, that and an editor, that's pretty much what they use. So you obviously want to find out what they're doing. If it's a music station or if it's a talk station, obviously the needs are significantly different. And we did, you know, in Bridgeport, we had one talk station and one music station. So the studios are quite a bit different. In the talk studio, they're both – we generally like to have a stand-up control room for pretty much everything. Of course, ADA, we need to have one sit-down height studio. So we did that in a production room in Bridgeport, and the talk studio is a sit down height for the talent and the guests. But the air studios, the control rooms are both stand up height, and typically in Cumulus that's what we're doing. And it's really a lot of it is what space do we have? We have to take all the things into consideration. If there's a number of how many guests are there. In a morning show, is it like a morning show standalone? Is it a morning show with a host and a co-host? Mm. You know, we're generally trying to build when we do. We generally are trying to build enough capacity in there that if it is a single morning show that we're figuring at some point in the future, they probably will have a co-host. So we build the position in there and make sure it's available. And then room for a guest or two. And the same goes for any kind of a talk situation. How many people would they? What kind of a talk environment is it? In Bridgeport, they did local talk every afternoon, and the host would bring the mayor in. We also used the studios for a lot of guest programming or special programming on weekends, where somebody would buy a block of time and come in and talk about sports for an hour. Believe it or not, they were pretty popular. They had a lot of people that would come in and out of the place on weekends and talk about whatever it is that they seem to want to talk about. So we had to build with that in mind. I don't know if I specifically answered your question, but hopefully that gives you some idea of the process.
It does. I think the considerations are probably less now than they were before, but there's also seems like there's often a requirement to build a studio into a smaller space or fit more of them effectively into a small end of a hallway or one side of a hallway. You may have to put six control rooms in close proximity to each other.
No doubt about it. With consolidation, we're definitely building smaller studios, and we are trying to fit more into a smaller space. We did I'm in Harrisburg, PA, which is where my office is, and we built this place about 10 years ago, the studios here are not huge. but they're not tiny either. And so, you know, they're pretty good size. But probably today, if we were to do it, we probably would be – we probably could fit about two or three more studios in here.
You know, with the dependence that so many stations have today on automation systems and periods of time when there's nobody in the studio, and, you know, we could argue all day about, you know, how good or bad that is for radio. But when you do build a new studio, what considerations do you try to make to accommodate the people who will be working in there, as far in terms of windows that they can see out of and see, you know, see the weather if they have to, or just have some sunlight coming in? Are there still considerations for creature comforts?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, we try to make sure that you know that there's a that there's some if the view is available, you know, we try to pick a nice location for the studios so that they do have some kind of an outside view. In Bridgeport, for example, we actually moved Weeby into the corner office, which had been I think it actually was the WICC studio at one time, but. We moved it into this room, which turned out to be a fairly large office and a fairly large studio and moved a couple of other walls around and gave them a really nice showcase studio to make it enjoyable for them to work in. And also because it's such a high profile radio station, we wanted the place to look good for guests to come in and advertisers.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah. You do want to make advertising.
Yeah, we try. We did that too. And also in Bridgeport, we did that here, where we try to turn our rack room into a showcase as well. We put it in behind this nice glass wall in Bridgeport, and mm-hmm. when some advertisers or guests walk in, they walk right past the tech center. They see all the flashy lights and. See all the equipment and things, meters moving and all that kind of stuff. And it looks like showbiz and radio, and it's nice and neat and it's impressive.
Hey, I'm curious about your workflow when you're planning and then you actually begin building a new studio. I was a kind of engineer that always wanted to get some tunes playing as soon as possible. So I'd get the speakers put up, get the power amp put in. I guess nowadays we tend to buy speakers that have built-in amps. But I'd get some tunes, and that way that helped me whenever I'd put a new source into the console, wire something new, and I could right then check it for, you know, ground loops or hum or, you know, quality and such. But there's also considerations like there's a lot of stuff that I consider, you know, necessary but not fun to do, like grounding work from studio to studio or studio, you know, to a central grounding point, grounding for the rack room, all those things you have to do that, by golly, they can take days to get done. But you got to do them probably first. Talk to me a bit about that. What's the order of when does the furniture go in? When does the grounding go in? And when does, you know, conduits or other such cabling necessities start going in?
Well, usually the conduits and the before the racks even go up, generally the conduits are going in. The electrical has been roughed in. We'll bring in the racks and. Get the rack room started simultaneously, mm-hmm. and what I've done usually in the past is I'll work with a couple of guys, and my job is usually the rack room, and I'll have maybe another guy or two working on studios, and they'll be assembling studios. We have one guy who likes to put furniture together, so we'll fly him around, and he's our guy that will assemble all the studio furniture, and
He's always got a job hanging out in front of an IKEA store if he needs to.
And he's about, you know, he's a pretty big guy, so he can pretty well handle the furniture on his own without any problem. we do occasionally need to help him because we've had some pretty big studios that we've done in the past. But he'll put the furniture together, and then a couple of guys will work on wiring the studios. And I would be working on getting the rack room put together. So a lot of things are going on at the same time. But I think ahead of time, usually before we start any real work, we've run the cabling, any trunking that goes on. Of course, now we're not really running trunking between studios. We're running, you know, bundles of Cat 6 or Cat 5e through. Mm-hmm. So to make sure that we can accommodate, you know, the IP audio or any... if we do run any analog audio across or AES audio, of course, it works very well on that stuff. So you don't need to necessarily be running trunk cables like, you know, big bundles of 25-pair GEPCO like we used to run.
So that's a good point. You know, nowadays you can get by with pretty much just pulling, you know, category cable, Cat 5e or Cat 6 cable from a central office, a central rack room to your studios. And you can run balanced audio on that, AES balanced. And of course, your Ethernet IP for, you know, one or more. If you have several networks, as many people do now, if their AOIP system is on a separate network and their business network is on a separate network, and who knows, maybe there's even a separate network for just for telephony, you know, for SIP phones and that kind of thing. You can do it all on the same kind of cable.
Yeah, you can. And Shreveport, we did. We actually ran all the audio, and Shreveport was a more traditional facility because we had a router system, a TDM router system that we put in there, and we had run all the audio over Cat5e bundles with, you know, 25 pair Cat5e, but we didn't run the network in the same bundles that we ran the audio. I wasn't very comfortable doing that, so we ran the individual Cat5es across for the network and the telco stuff, but did all the audio in Cat5e because we and it saved us a lot of money overrunning AES cables. And the reason that we did it was kind of funny. We didn't do it to save money, because we did it because when we went to price out all the cabling we needed and find the availability, it wasn't available. And we were on a waiting. They said, "Well, yeah, you can have that, but it's going to be like 2 months before we can get you this, you know, GEPCO 25, you know, the 24 pair GEPCO AES stuff that we used." And they were like, "So we decided to try just using standard Cat5e, and it worked great."
Man, wouldn't you like to be the guy? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The only thing that you got to watch is you cannot run any unbalanced audio on it. If you do that, you blow it up.
Leak right away. By the way, could you take a minute? And I know there's some people in our audience who are, you know, not sure about that. What you mean by balanced and unbalanced, and why can't you run unbalanced audio, whatever that is, to help us understand, over these twisted pair of wires when they're next to each other? What happens?
Well, generally, crosstalk is what happens. It's balanced audio. You've got two wires, okay, in a twisted pair, and the field cancels out the. I'm not sure how to describe it as much as just it because it's the same but inverse waveform on each of the two wires. They cancel out any crosstalk that would be that would occur on any of the other wires in the bundle. I'm not sure if I'm even describing that properly.
No, you use some different words than I usually do, but which is why I wanted you to describe it to help folks understand. I think I've explained this once or twice, but it doesn't mean that I'm explaining it right. But you're right. When you have that's why wires in a Cat 5 or, you know, a category cable are twisted, because they you're right. One wire carries an inverted version of the signal that the other wire is carrying. So it's like push pull, push pull, push pull, push pull. And when you twist these, you give them kind of an infinitely common and small axis. They're not an individual wire that's running along and radiating. The two in the long form act as one wire, and so the radiation, you know, from signals that are on the wire cancel each other out from the two wires over, you know, a length, and that means that they don't interfere with cables next to them because they're not putting much of any energy out. Also, it means that they don't accept much energy in. This is because any hum, any signal that is magnetically being imposed on that twisted pair is being imposed in what we call a common mode. It's equally on the hot and the cold, or the plus and the minus wire. And so when it gets to its destination, this common mode signal, which may indeed get picked up somewhere, this common mode signal disappears at the receiver because the receiver is looking for differential mode. It's looking for a difference in the signal in the two wires at any given instance. If the signal is the same riding on the two wires, you know, in common, then that signal just gets rejected, as it does on a transformer. You know, that's why an audio transformer is such a great thing for an input when you're in a noisy environment. So good explanation. So if you have an unbalanced device, like a consumer CD player or whatever it may be, you've got to balance that audio first, either with a passive transformer or with an active, you know, a balancing amp, like, you know, from Henry or any number of other companies. And when you do that, you don't have a problem.
There you go.
Pretty cool. I also think it's cool that you can use like one of these Fluke meters or other brands too to measure the crosstalk between pairs in a Cat 5 cable. And you know, if you terminate those things wrongly, I mean, this is basically RF. When you have a Cat 5 cable with IP Ethernet mm-hmm. on it, it's basically mm-hmm. RF. That's what up to 3-4 megahertz even higher. And if you don't punch them down and terminate them properly, that they can, you know, at the points where they're not routed quite right, you can get crosstalk between them. And that's what these meters measure. Okay, what's my near-end crosstalk and what's my far-end crosstalk? And the cool thing is, if you get it right for the Ethernet, it'll be right for the audio, right?
That's right, yeah.
The audio is not nearly as demanding.
If it works for – absolutely. If it works for the Ethernet, it'll definitely work for AES or the audio. That's right.
Good deal. Hey, folks, if you just tuned in, you're watching This Week in Radio Tech. It's episode number 203. I'm Kirk Harnack, and I'm a pleasure to be talking for the whole hour with Dave Suplee. Dave works for the folks at Cumulus Broadcasting, and Dave is their expert at building new studios and building transmitter sites and, you know, fixing broken ones when that happens. I met Dave and was introduced to him as the guy that travels and builds. So we're talking to Dave about some of the techniques that he's learned and how he builds studios. We're going to get around to talking about transmitter sites too. And also, Dave, if you'll think about it during our ad here, we take a break for an ad, think about some of the tips and tricks that you've learned along the way. And I'll bet they're just as common as hen's teeth. That's not common at all. I bet they're common to you and maybe uncommon to other people. So, see if you can think of some tips and tricks you'd like to pass along to your fellow engineers. Hey, the show is brought to you by my friends at the Telus Alliance and Axia. And I want to tell you about the big console, the console that just really put Axia on the map, and that is the Axia Element audio console. This is an audio over IP console. And the Element, you know, can be any size. I've been in studios. Actually, I've been in the same studio in France where they had a two-fader console. Yes, it was two faders and the monitor section so that the big honcho announcer could run his own little board. And right across the table from that was the world's largest Axia console. This is at the Energy Network in France. And it had something like 40 faders. It was actually two Axia Element frames, actually three of them, all butted up together, bolted together to make a huge 40-fader console with a bunch of custom controls on it. So the point is, no matter what size console you need, up to about 40 faders, the Axia Element can accommodate you. The Element is incredibly strong. You talk about something that is not sheet metal that's stamped out and laminated, folks. The Axia Element console is built on an extruded aluminum, well, it's an aluminum extrusion that is complex and beautiful in its design and is extremely strong. We can extrude this thing out 4 feet long, and it's just as rigid as can be. And all of the things we need to slide in, circuit boards and panels, over bridges, they all just slide right in. And then the modules themselves that contain either faders or phone controller modules, intercom, whatever modules need to go in, those just slip right in. And they have the most ingenious design for bolting in. Two bolts at the top, and at the bottom there is a rubber gasket pressure mechanism that doesn't let these modules slide around. Let's imagine you didn't quite screw the bolts down tight. They won't move around in there. They're held by this linear rubber gasket. It's the most ingenious design and just gorgeous. I'm telling you, you can stand on this console. Not that I recommend it, and it's a little bit harder to operate the faders with your feet. But it's just such a beautifully built, long-lasting, and durable console. It is the kind of console that you can place on the tabletop without cutting a hole if you want to. It's low enough in its design, but it does look better sitting in a hole. So you can cut a hole out in the top of your tabletop and lay that Element console right in there. Plenty of folks have even taken out their old audio console and put a new top or a little bit of an extended top on the top and then cut a new hole for their Axia Element. What else can I tell you about the Element? Well, it has just so many features that make life really easy for disc jockeys and board operators. Before the show, Andrew and I were just talking about automatic mix minus. That's one of the hallmarks of Axia consoles. So no matter what remote audio you bring in from a codec, from a telephone line, no matter what you bring in, the fader can make an automatic mix minus. Even if the path back to the person who's calling in is different. Let's say you have a reporter coming in via a satellite link. Well, the return audio won't be by satellite. Let's say it's by a dial-up telephone, an IFB. You can make that work very easily so that the board operator never has to worry about how to get the remote person to hear properly. Mix minus is automatic. We never send the caller back to the caller or the remote reporter back to the remote reporter. It's always the correct mix minus audio so that everybody can participate just fine. In fact, we're using that feature right now on this show. That's how I'm able to hear Dave Suplee and not hearing myself back, you know, a half a second or a full second later due to the delays inherent with Skype. So just one of the features about the Axie Element console. Built-in mic processing, as many mics as you put on there. You can do parametric EQ and mic processing with downward expansion and also de-essing. So just as cool as can be. I want you to go to the web and check it out. Whether you need a small Element console like I have at one of my radio stations or a huge, big, honking Element console like Energy has or anything in between, check it out on the web. Go to axiaaudio.com and then click on the link to the products and the Element Audio console, axiaaudio.com. Thanks a lot, Axia, for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech and giving me a chance to brag about the those Axia consoles. All right. In fact, there's one right across the room from me here. I need to – I guess I should play with it more. All right, Dave Suplee is our guest on episode 203. Dave, let's hear a little bit about transmitter sites. You've been to a bunch of them. You've probably built a few of them. Tell me about kind of, you know, what's your favorite thing about dealing with transmitter sites?
You really want to know what my favorite thing is?
Sure,
that there's usually not a lot of people around to bother me.
I knew you were going to go there. Yeah. Have you seen that? There's a meme. I mean, there's all kinds of memes on Facebook and the internet, but there's that meme where the, name escapes me. The doctor, somebody. And he says, "Oh, engineer is at the transmitter." Right? How many times have we been accused of always at the transmitter?
Oh, yeah, all the time. And, he's always at the transmitter. I don't understand, you know. But, serious. I think that is one of the things that I do like about the transmitters is not necessarily that you're there by yourself, but you can really focus in and clear your mind and work on things, work with your hands, and maybe you're not sitting in front of the computer answering a million emails or dealing with stuff on the phone, and really can just be an engineer. And a lot of us that got into it early on, it's my first console that I ever worked on was full of tubes, and so I'd go in once a month with a tube tester and check everything out and that kind of stuff, and you know, working on cart machines and reel-to-reel machines, and that part of the industry is obviously long gone. But the transmitters are still something that require a lot more hands-on than just about anything else that we do. And so that's one of the fun parts of it. Of course, the newer solid-state transmitters are just fantastic when it comes to getting them installed. We put a new Harris transmitter on for a Nash in New York for our launch there last spring. Basically, really? From the time it rolled out of the rolled off the truck in West Orange, New Jersey, until we had it on the air, it was less than a day. It was actually about 5 hours because we had planned ahead of time and everything was ready to go. We just had the electrician come in and hook up the wires, and we had the hard line done, and off we went. IP remote control. So,
oh, that's cool. Yeah. Now, so an engineer like me, I used to do this very full time, and it used to be that almost every transmitter I dealt with the exception of a couple of Nautel AMs, had a tube in it. And nowadays, I guess the stations I own, we do have a couple of small rack mounted FM transmitters that are solid state. But if I were to jump into engineering, broadcast engineering now, with so many solid state transmitters and this becoming the norm, what's going to impress me about that? Or what do I need to look out for? What do I need to be aware of in this new world of solid state broadcast transmitters?
Well, solid state broadcast transmitters are, obviously there's a few models out there that do go up to the higher power. And, of course, the question is, are you going to do HD or not do HD? Because that makes a big difference. If you're not going to be doing HD, then you then you probably obviously your transmitter cost is going to be significantly less. Yeah. And especially if you were going to be doing high level HD with a solid state transmitter, you know, it's a big heater. So you need to make sure that you've got sufficient air conditioning to handle it. That's always a sticking point that we run into. So there's all kinds of different ways you can roll the HD game or just not do it at all. You know, obviously a reputable manufacturer. I think that's probably the main thing, is to make sure that the person, the company that you're buying that transmitter from, is going to be around to support it. You know, you can still get parts for the tube transmitters, and most of the old tube transmitters that are out there, the biggest issue that we see is getting the smaller tubes. I mean, the big PA tubes they still make, but we still have some old CCAs, you know, that are sitting in, some of them are in main service and others are in backup service. We have a few of the old Gates AM transmitters still floating around that have you know, tubes in them, and they're, you know, either mains or they're most. I think that there's maybe one or two that are still in service as the main, but most of them are as backups. And you know, here in Harrisburg, I have an ITA kilowatt that's a tube transmitter, and that's running as a backup, and it's perfectly reliable. The issue with it is finding the smaller tubes are getting harder and harder to find, and the quality of the tubes is of the glass type that we used to use is getting a little bit iffy as far as the, you know, to go out and get a glass vacuum tube. You're pretty much, I don't think that anybody in the United States is making them anymore, and yeah, they can't be rebuilt. The ceramic tubes that are used in the Continentals. And the you know, there's a million Continental transmitters out there, and there's a the Harris transmitters, the Harris tube transmitters, and most of the anything that's running on FM, and most of the transmitters that are running, you know, 15, 20 kilowatts and higher are still tube transmitters. Although you can do solid state in that range, it's just, you know, there's a point where it's effective. It's cost effective. It's more cost effective to go with a tube than it is solid state because of power consumption. Although it's my understanding that the new designs that are in the works are probably going to make the solid state higher power transmitter a more efficient option than it has been previously.
You're right. You know, especially at the FM frequencies, solid state devices, as of, you know, 10, 15 years ago, were not efficient at all. And so you had to burn up a whole lot of heat in making an FM solid-state transmitter. AMs were a lot better. At a megahertz, a solid-state device can be pretty efficient. And certainly Nautel has made a great business of making solid-state AM transmitters for a long time. But FMs, you say, are getting more efficient. So that's good to hear.
Yeah, it's evolving. Yeah, the Nautel, the AM transmitters, obviously there have been solid-state transmitters since Harris came out with the MW1, which I think it was still a Gates in like 1970 or 70, 71 or 72, whenever the first solid-state AMs were out. And, you know, that's been an evolving product, and a lot of those transmitters, it's actually maybe a little harder to get parts for than it was their older predecessors that are running the tube, that are running the tubes. And the reason for that is because the semiconductors have been discontinued for
end of life on semiconductors. Yeah.
Right. But you can still get tubes, and you can still get, you know, resistors and capacitors, and there are people that will still wind transformers and things like that. So you can keep the old ones going in some ways more easily.
So think about the engineering that you do at various transmitter sites, both the ones that you take care of on a regular basis and, you know, ones that you build or help build for other Cumulus stations. You've been doing this long enough, Dave, that you probably are not making the same mistakes over and over again when you're installing or planning. what are one or two things that still bite you in the butt? You know, that's still, oh, man, I knew that was going to happen. Or isn't there a solution to this problem? Maybe it's surge or lightning or, you know, inept operators. I don't know. But
walking,
can you
out,
think of something that still bites you in the butt?
Absolutely. Walking out the door with the transmitter or the remote control in local. That's the one thing that gets you almost every time. And, you know, so as a result, I've got, you know, signs on all the doors of transmitters saying, you know, did you put the transmitter in local, that kind of stuff. But inevitably, you know, every so often, I'll go to call it and it's like, oh, well, I can't do anything. I must have left it in local. Or worse yet, you go and change something and it fails. And then you call the transmitter and you find that the remote control is in local and you can't do anything. So you have to drive up there, which can be an issue at some sites. But that's probably the one big one is
what if somebody made a remote control that you could that had Bluetooth? Right, and so you could program your iPhone or your Android when you're in proximity, it would flash a light that would let you go to local mode if you want to. Wouldn't switch it automatically, but when you walk away,
it goes back. That's a great idea. You ought to patent that. That's really a fantastic idea. Why don't you build that?
Actually, you know, I think one of our support engineers at Telos, a guy named Matt Rockwell, he's doing that in his house. When he leaves his house, stuff happens automatically because he's gone.
Oh yeah.
And on his way home, when he walks through the front door, stuff unhappens.
Stuff happens in my house when I leave, but it's usually because my dogs and cats have been at doing something, playing or something.
Remote local proximity switch. You know what I still see?
A great idea. I like that.
What I still see on Facebook that in the I post pictures of transmitter sites, that forum, people still, because it still happens. There hasn't been, to my knowledge, a great improvement in this technology. It's when transmission lines and antennas fail, sometimes precipitated by a lightning strike or precipitated by water in the system, not keeping it pressurized. But sometimes it happens, you know, you get an RF switch that fails draws a big arc and then stuff starts to burn up. Wouldn't it be, you know, does that kind of stuff still get you?
Not really, because, you know, I know enough that, we wire in the interlocks to the transfer switches and hopefully that doesn't happen. Now, the things that do get you, transmission lines burn up, antennas burn up. You know, sometimes with antennas, even just the towers move. They're not sitting there rock solid. And if you've ever been on a broadcast tower, no matter what the size is, it moves. It vibrates
and sways. Yeah,
it sways, it shakes, what have you, and that over a period of time is going to be moving those internal components of the antenna. The antenna is not one big solid piece; it's a lot of pieces that are put together. And where those pieces come together, you'll see one antenna in particular will. Because of the inner conductors and the bullets that touch them that match up with the inner conductors, the expansion and contraction of just heating and cooling plus the motion of the tower as it moves around in the wind over time will drop little bits of metal on some of the insulating material below. And ultimately it builds off enough little bits of metal that, as we know, metal and electricity work together very well, and electronics and RF go together very well. So you get a nice arc, and it burns a hole in your antenna and lets all the magic smoke out, and it no longer works because it's all escaped. And maybe if you're even less lucky, all that stuff will catch fire, melt down through the insulating material, drop down into your coax, and contaminate that as well. And then you've lost both of them. And that does happen. And it's one of those things that is almost impossible to predict and almost impossible to prevent. So fortunately, it doesn't happen often, but I've seen it several times.
As an engineer, you're probably public-facing from time to time, like when a complaint call comes in the station. I'm picking your station up on my telephone. You know, that kind of thing. As a public-facing person, and we sometimes do have these responsibilities, what's your attitude about dealing with that kind of call or complaints from listeners?
Well, I usually don't mind doing that. I mean, I try to be, you know, most people that call, they've got a problem and they're looking for an answer. You know, they're not calling just to hassle you. So, I'm always very, very polite to people when they call. And fortunately, I don't have a lot, but I've had a few. And it's usually, you know, somebody who's maybe down in my AM site and exactly what you're saying. They've had problems with their telephone. And so I have a vendor that supplies filters that I'll you know, drop it off at their house, or I'll have somebody drop it off at their house, or I'll, you know, stick it in the mail for them and say, here, plug this into your, you know, phone and get back to me if it doesn't solve the problem. And nine times out of 10, it works. I haven't, you know, not run into too many people where, you know, they come back and they're irate about things. Most people are pretty understanding.
You know, you mentioned you had a supplier that, that can help you out, and you just reminded me of that, this famous place that sells lots of telephone doodads to fix problems called Sandman. You ever use them?
I have. Have I used? I don't think so. I don't think so. I'm going to have to write them down.
Yes, it's a Sandman.com, telecom and cable installations product and training. But they have, of course, they have, you know, butt sets of every description, you know, message on hold equipment, all kinds of older and newer telephone stuff. A loop current booster, for example, if you have an extension phone just way out in the barn on the back 40, and you need some loop current boosting going on. But they have RF filters of various RF eliminators, they call them, filters that are good for AM and FM frequencies. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty cool. That's good source.
One of the weirdest complaints I ever got was I had a lady call me one time that was telling me that that the leaves on the sides of the trees toward our tower changed colors sooner in autumn than the leaves that were away from our tower.
Okay.
And there was another station that their antenna is very close to ours here in Harrisburg, and she was saying that when they changed format a couple of years ago, it took her a long time until she felt normal after that. Not that she listened to the station, but it disrupted the airwaves so much with their change to country music. And you know, those are the kind of people that you just have to say, yeah, I understand. I understand. It's okay. And you know, I'm really sorry to hear that. And you know, I don't know if I can really do anything about what you're calling, but it's just, you know, most of the person wanted to talk to somebody and discuss her theories about how the leaves turn sooner and a different color too.
Different color. Yeah.
Toward the antenna.
So I guess, not that we're doing a tip of the day or anything or tip of the week, but, I'd forgotten about Sandman.com until you mentioned those filters. That's just a great resource. Do you have a particular resource, a tool, a piece of software that you just love and don't know how you got along without, or a supplier, or, you know, some product that you'd like to pass along a tip to other folks, other engineers?
You know, probably the most useful thing that I have is a BitBuddy, and I can you know, and it's not really a tip as much as anything. It's just one of the most useful tools ever made when it comes to any kind of audio studio issue. It is just about as handy as it gets. So that's the BitBuddy and the your basic inexpensive audio sniffer are two of the most useful things that I have.
Isn't the audio sniffer a great thing? Fox and Hound, as some people call them.
Yeah. You've used that we've used it for just about anything, you know, trying to identify wires or figuring out what's mm-hmm. going on. And if you're really clever with it, you can figure out if you've got an unbalanced wire that's off, unbalanced pair that's off, you can hear on one side or the other more or less audio. So you can usually tell where the problem is coming from.
Yeah. Are those Fox and Hound kits, they used to be about $75 or $80 for the little tone warbler. And then the sniffer, are they still about that much money?
That's about right. Yeah, the last time I bought one. I routinely lose them every couple of years and, you know, leave them somewhere or what have you, step on them, drop them, you know, that kind of thing. So last time I bought them, I think they were about 50.
Sounds like, you know, if your BitBuddy has been so helpful to you over the years, and that's for AES audio, right?
That's AES, and it also does analog.
Oh, it does analog too. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be cool to
I haven't found
little...
the equivalent yet for the IP world.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah, that's what we need. A little handheld that does, you know, it does LiveWire, it does Wheatnet, it does Dante, and it does the new AES-67 standard. It does Ravenna. Wouldn't that be cool? And it maybe even lets you. Oh, that would be just awesome. You could just.
That would be nice. That would be nice. Yeah. Somebody should invent that, Kirk. You know, what do you think?
Making it small might be the tough part.
Making it small might be the tough part. But, you know, just even a single in and out, you could plug in a set of headphones into it or something, and a you know, RJ45 for you to get whatever piece of audio you want into it would be very useful.
That'd be it sure would. That'd be awesome. Mm-hmm. Dave, we're almost out of time. Have we talked about anything, or have we not yet talked about something that you wanted to discuss, that you're passionate about, something along the lines of engineering or engineering management, dealing with disc jockeys or program directors, whatever you'd like to pass along?
You know, the thing that you talked about, maybe tips that I had for studios and building studios, and I think that, you know, I work with a lot of engineers, and I work with, I think, some of the best engineers in the country. I get to work at some of the legendary radio stations. You know, I get to come in and cause trouble, you know, in some of the neatest places that you'd ever want to go to. Last year, we got to play with the antenna tuning unit at WLS in Chicago. You know, the big 89.
I've been there, yeah.
And I mean, that was just great. It's cool.
Yeah.
But you know, it's one of the things that I have picked up. And when you think about, you know, in Cumulus, I think I like to say, and I think it's true that we have the best engineers in the country. And when I look at the guys that are really good, and the guys that really there are the guys that never seem to have that always seem to have it under control, and then there's some guys that maybe seem to have a little more trouble keeping things running than others do, and the guys that really have it under control, the engineers, that the biggest tip that I can give is, it's very simple. It's be prepared. And be prepared and be flexible. If no matter what you're doing, when you walk out the door in the morning, you need to have a plan. You need to know what you're going to do. You know, just walk in the station and say, "Oh, well, here it is. It's Monday. What am I going to do today?" You know, carry a planner. Some of the most effective people I know still use the handwritten Franklin planners or day timers or that kind of thing. And that's probably the difference that I see. It's not necessarily the people that are the smartest people. I'm not one of the smartest people, I can tell you that. I mean, I'm not a very my knowledge of electronic theory is not that strong, I'll be honest with you. But I think I plan things well, I implement things well, and I think that's a big difference. The other thing is when you're doing studios or any kind of work, documentation and labeling your wires is essential. You have no idea how many sites I go into where people have not documented things or the wires aren't labeled because you know, they got in a hurry and they thought, well, you know, I'll go back and do that later, and I know what that wire is, and a year later they go back and they say, what? I don't remember what that wire did. And why did I put that? Why did I put that there? And you know, that kind of stuff. So I mean, that's really my passion as much as in the business is. I like to try to help guys. I like to try to help engineers. As a regional engineer, it's really my job is there to support the guys and to try to take the guys that need help and help them do better jobs, and the guys that that maybe just need to get stuff done through corporate, I try to do that too. But I like to see people try to be prepared and know what they're going to do. And you also have to be flexible because, you know, things break, things happen, things change. Somebody comes along, changes your plans, and you have to be able to handle that change and not have your world come apart because all of a sudden you had planned on going to this transmitter site today, but the market manager comes in and says, "Hey, I need you to move some offices for me because I've got two new salespeople starting." So that's the kind of stuff that you can't just fall apart if something like that comes down the road. You got to be able to roll with it a little bit. So that's my that's all I really had on that.
Supplies thoughts. Ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of a This Week in Radio Tech. By the way, that's good advice. And the be prepared, you know, that you, of course you got to have experience in order to know what to prepare for. I did contract engineering for what, almost 20 years out in my garage. I've got all my tools that I used to use, and you know, over the years they didn't get more and more and more tools. They kind of got whittled down to a set of tools that would solve 98% of the problems 98% of the time. But, you know, there are a few tools that, well, I don't have that one with me. I'm going to have to go back and get that. But you know what? I didn't need it the last 100 trips I made. So it takes experience to know, you know, what is worth dragging around and what isn't.
You know, there's a saying, and I think it was I forget who it was, a football coach I think that said it, but it really made sense to me because somebody said, "What's luck?" You know, these particular team won the game because, you know, they got a few lucky calls, and I think the coach said, "Well, you know, there really is no such thing as luck. It's more like experience meets opportunity." And being prepared, or being prepared meets opportunity, I think is what he said. And I think that that's true. I think that the people that being prepared and having the experience comes with being prepared to deal with whatever comes your way, and seeing the opportunity that may arise when a particular situation occurs.
Dave, it's been a pleasure and a delight, and we're out of time. I appreciate you taking an hour out of your time to be here. Thanks so much. And, hey, maybe on a future show, you could give us a little tour of your Harrisburg studios there. We'd love to show off studios. That would be a very cool thing to do.
I'd love to, and I'd love to join you again sometime.
All right. Dave Suplee with Cumulus in Harrisburg, PA. He travels all over and builds studios when, you know, he's your studio hitman. I'm glad he's out there doing it for Cumulus and making the radio industry better for those who work in it. I'm Kirk Harnack. You've been watching This Week in Radio Tech. This has been episode number 203, brought to you by the Telos Alliance and the Axia Element audio console on the web at axiaaudio.com. Our thanks to Andrew Zarian, the producer of the show, and to the GFQ Network, Andrew's big baby, who gets us out all over the world every week. Appreciate it very much. Be sure you go to the website, thisweekinradiotech.com or gfqnetwork.com. You can download, you can watch or listen, and you can subscribe to the podcast there. Subscribing is the best way to do it. It shows up in your media device automatically every week or so. Check it out. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.